opposite coup in Pakistan, it is clear that once again it's the army's turn to govern that country for a while at least. The coup, of course, has been highly criticized by some, and the gentleman, the general who led the coup, Mr. Musharraf, General Musharraf, has been praised by others. We're going to talk a little about it and see where things stand now as we're joined by Imran Anwar, founder of ImranNet Services in New York, pioneer of internet email in Pakistan, and of course, well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia. Hi, Imran.
Hello, George.
Where are we post the coup at this point? What's happening in Pakistan?
Well, basically, George, there have been some developments in the sense of things sort of falling into place. There has not been a clear statement on when and actually if ever democracy is going to be restored, and even if it is, what shape and form it might take. So things are happening, but nothing that clarifies the situation as far as democracy is concerned.
How do you assess this general? He has been praised by many as being an open-minded person in many ways, a bit of a liberal, really, but how liberal, no one is quite sure. And I don't know, a fairly commendable person generally. That has been one side of it, at least. How do you assess it?
Those assessments are correct, George, and he's a pragmatic sort of person, and he is also somebody who is a man of action. My only concern is that there is a tendency for things not to be talked through very clearly, so being reactive can sometimes lead to disastrous results, no matter how good your intentions, and that is my concern.
Yeah, I've heard that criticism from people that supposedly know him, and that's general, talking about him, saying that the one flaw he might have is that he tends to, in essence, do things from a knee-jerk reaction a bit.
Absolutely.
Was this a knee-jerk reaction, or was this thought through, at least the to this point?
So, both of the above, George. When you look at the fact that he was in a plane on his way back, and there appears to be some discussion that the government was interested in letting the plane crash or land in some place where it would be difficult for him to get back in time to sort of put up any kind of resistance. Yet for his troops to come in and take over the government and the country shows that this was obviously something that had been thought about. Thought about is different from thought through, so it was well thought about and it was well planned, and they were able to execute quickly and correctly in taking over power. But the fact that once he came in, he did not have a statement ready, for example, and even to this date, we don't know what the direction is for the restoral of democracy, if at all, shows that things are thought about, but not completely always thought through.
Now, rate the so-called democratic situation, the democracy in Pakistan pre the coup, under the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. It has been, I was surprised to learn, and as I watched the discussions by both Pakistanis for the most part that were being interviewed and Indians that were often being interviewed, there was a great deal of criticism and skepticism and cynicism about the democracy of the past Prime Minister.
Absolutely, George. That is what General Pervez Musharraf has going for him. Even if it's been a knee-jerk reaction, even if he has basically committed high treason in as many words, which could be something punishable by death. But the fact that people are celebrating is a sad thing to see how badly the politicians have screwed up despite all the opportunities they got. And this includes Nawaz Sharif as well as Benazir Bhutto in self-imposed exile and living abroad in a luxurious apartment in Europe. The fact of the matter is that they have been equally guilty of plundering. Actually, it is said that Benazir Bhutto's husband has been more guilty, but that does not mean Nawaz Sharif's crimes were any less. The problem has been that these people have had the opportunity, they did nothing, while economically the country was spiraling downwards and the lot of the common man was becoming even even worse on a daily basis, which means that people are more interested, much like in Indonesia as we speak on a regular basis, people were more interested in finding a solution to their problems than in finding out who is running the affairs. As a matter of fact, I would argue that people are happy to have somebody who's a dictator and will solve problems, as opposed to someone they elect who then turns around and plunders their wealth.
Well, let me ask about that. A couple of things about the Prime Minister Sharif. First of all, elected in a democratic election, but as I understand it, a lot of questions can be raised about how democratic the election really is, how much of a democracy really ever existed in Pakistan. They have, in essence, a kind of a feudal system. People that own great blocks or tracts of land and virtually control the population there, and any vote that would come from there would come almost under their directive. And so there may be great questions about how truly democratic the process was. You know, what is your assessment of that?
That may be partially true, George, and has held true in the past, especially in areas with feudal landlords where, you know, tens of thousands of employees and laborers work for large family-owned farmers and landowners, and Benazir Bhutto's family is part of this this sort of group. Nawaz Sharif actually is not a landowner. Nawaz Sharif's family is an industrialist family, which has gotten richer during his regimes as Prime Minister. That does not mean that he has those same four-year masses to go vote for you power available to him. The fact is that democracy and the election were played out correctly. It's just that if only 15 or 20% of the people go and vote, it's a democratic vote, all right, by definition, but quite frankly, if only 15 or 20% people are voting, then one could say that people were disenfranchised with democracy even at that stage before martial law came in, and that was the proof of the low turnout.
Now, also, it has been, the criticism has been leveled against Mr. Sharif that, and I could quote from a recent edition of The Economist, the Prime Minister had systematically undermined every institution capable of challenging or even questioning him, from the courts to the press to the parliament, and that in fact the only institution left with any legs to challenge him, and did so just in time, would have been the army, the military, Mr. Musharraf, the General Musharraf. Is that what Nawaz Sharif was up to?
Absolutely, George, and that is a very correct assessment. What we have found, actually, in the last four sort of civilian governments that we've had in Pakistan for the last 11 or 14 or whatever odd years, is that each of the elected leaders, including Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, were more interested in becoming elected dictators and kings and queens, basically, as opposed to actually solving any real problems. The only positive thing I have to say for Nawaz Sharif's government, the times that it came into power, was that him being an industrialist gave him the opportunity to see the benefits of economic development, of building communications infrastructure. Of course, there were kickbacks to be had in all of these big deals, but at least things were done in terms of making the economic revival somewhat visible, as opposed to what was happening in Benazir Bhutto's time, when literally nothing was getting done. Now, Nawaz Sharif, from that point on, also realized that since he does not have the feudal power base, the only way to make sure that he always stays in power would be to go after anything that could challenge him. So he went after the administration, he went after the judiciary, and that was a very visible fight, and he actually literally had judges beaten up and threatened, and the Supreme Court and the High Court buildings attacked with his supporters to put them in their place, and led to the dismissal of the Chief Justice, and so he had the judiciary taken care of. The press was seriously attacked by him. The Jung Group of newspapers is the largest newspaper chain. They literally had tax evasion charges and treason charges and God knows what charges thrown at them, literally just to make them toe the Prime Minister's line. So this has been a systematic destruction of institutions, yes. Was it something others have not done in the past? Of course they have, including Ms. Bhutto and her father, Mr. Bhutto. They all did that, but Nawaz Sharif made it a systematic destructive policy, and then going after the army was would have been the best thing he could have done to solidify power, but it became his undoing.
In a television speech after the coup, the general went on television and said that he had declared martial law and staged this this coup as a last resort because Mr. Sharif's government was destroying the state institutions and the economy. And you would be asked by that statement to look at this as we might look sympathetically on mutiny on the Bounty or something. A mutiny is a heinous thing, but sometimes it's the last resort, and there are some instances in history where maybe the sympathy would lie with the mutineers. Is it your assessment that we in the West ought to look at this coup in some sympathy?
Yes, George, I would say it has to be looked at in that context. However, not because I am cynical, but if I was talking to General Musharraf today, the question I would ask him would be, I can see the logic of you saying that you were watching the country spiral into destruction and you could not take it anymore. But my question would be, you have seen this destruction begin and get worse in the regime of General Ziaul-Haq, who was a military dictator, continue through three regimes, and the fourth one actually. How come it became a matter of national urgency and a national emergency the day that you were fired? That is my only concern. That is the only question that comes to my mind, which is suspect. Otherwise, the logic is there, but the cynicism has to remain because we have been down this road before.
I suppose you could say, the day after I'm fired, I can't do it.
Well, he had ample opportunity before that. And my second question then would be that I'm glad that we are going after these politicians who are crooked, but where will it stop? And are we going to have a time frame in terms of crimes committed in the last X years? Or are we going to go after all corrupt individuals? And will that include generals in the Pakistani army who have also been enriched? Because don't forget, the Pakistan army takes a huge chunk of the national wealth for its own running, and a lot of that money is stolen or mismanaged and ends up in the pockets of generals who get rich. Will they be targeted the same way that the politicians are? My feeling is that if he can do that, he can win hearts and win the nation's heart for the next 10 years.
So he has to face, in essence, a system that is permeated with corruption from everywhere. I mean, he has landlords, he has politicians, he has military, and who knows who else, and he has to put forward some anti-corruption campaign or other, and then he has to try to enforce it, and as you say, justly, that would also mean ferreting out those in the military who would be accused of such things. What has he done to this point that indicates that he might be up to the task, if anything?
Well, right now, the fact that it's an unelected honeymoon period, it's almost like the bride was not swept off her feet, but basically dragged by her hair, but still, it's a honeymoon nonetheless. But in this case, what we find is that since nobody is in a position to make statements, both because there is no real opposition, two, because the people are actually happy that this happened, so he actually has probably a little more time than anybody else would have to plot strategy. Just creating some organizations and announcing that this is being done, corruption will be weeded out is not enough. Some things that are being done are visible on the economic front. For example, the announcement of people who will be on the Supreme Council, so to speak, including Shaukat Aziz, the executive vice president who just left his job at Citibank in Manhattan to go take up those responsibilities, and who I know very well. And those are the kinds of steps that he's taking, bringing in capable people from the outside. But I don't know if he can do that on the corruption front.
What does his takeover of Pakistan mean to the relationship of Pakistan and India, the stability such as it is at the moment between Pakistan and India, and consequently to the international stability, frankly, of these two rather contentious nuclear powers?
That's a very good question, George, and the answer will be full of many ironies. The fact is that considering that the recent events in Kashmir were obviously done with the blessing of the army command which he was leading, it would appear very obvious that he wants to be very aggressive in Kashmir and solve the problem. At the same time, one of the first things he did was to de-escalate the military in all the regions of Pakistan's border with India, except Kashmir. So what I see happening is that he will have a great opportunity to carry the carrot and stick approach to India. Now, you have to keep in mind, India is 10 times the size of Pakistan, so he has to do it somewhat carefully, but that is one of the reasons Pakistan had always needed the nuclear option available to it, is that it does level the playing field, because having a nuclear weapon means that they can talk to India as equals, as Pakistan has always wanted. What I expect General Musharraf and his government basically to do is to tell India that we do not want any kind of fighting with you or any kind of war with you, and we would like to have good cordial relations, which we have enjoyed sometimes very well in the past, but the root cause of the problem is Kashmir, and that has to be solved. Now, this is where, George, I strongly feel this is a great opportunity for the United States and President Clinton, if he wants to leave a legacy of both nuclear non-proliferation and of bringing hot spots of the world to resolution. This would be a great opportunity for the American president to step in and say, listen, you people have these new governments, there's a lot of instability here, and we know what the root cause of the problem is. Let's solve that, and then we can make our involvement in this issue preconditioned with Pakistan's return to democracy in the next, let's say, 18 months.
It's a difficult position for the United States because we're on the horns of a dilemma. Under American law, we cannot really recognize a military takeover. Certainly, we have to cut off all aid. And if you really wanted to go by the book, you would have to say if this duly elected prime minister is not returned to office within X amount of time, then we have to cut off relations with Pakistan.
Correct, George. But let's not forget two very important facts. One, when General Zia-ul-Haq was came into power and actually hung the elected Prime Minister Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, the United States actually lined up with $3 billion to give to him to fight the Russians in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And since the U.S. and Pakistan actually enjoyed the closest economic ties at that time. Secondly, the things are slightly different in this case. General Musharraf is actually unelected, but welcomed by the Pakistani people because of the failure. So it would be easy for him to have a referendum tomorrow and have the people say, do you let me rule for the next 90 days or 90 months or whatever? And he could do that legally, even without coercing people. And so that is a technicality that can be easily overcome. But the downside to this issue not being resolved, Kashmir being the root cause, the downside to this is that you have two nuclear-capable enemies who can go to war repeatedly, but this time they might use the nuclear option.
You asked the question why the general made his move. Was it coincidence that he did so on the eve of his being fired or about to be fired? I would ask the question, how much of this was motivated by his distaste for the Prime Minister more or less capitulating to the U.S. and international pressure on the issue of Kashmir and withdrawing the forces from the Pakistani forces back into the Pakistani side, at least, of kind of an unofficial line of demarcation in Kashmir?
That's a good question, George, and it would be a good follow-up question. I still think my question is important.
I'm wondering if this was a factor also.
I was just trying to be humorous here. but seriously, that's a good question to ask. And I can bet you that there was obviously that, especially because once Nawaz Sharif capitulated to the United States, he went back and tried to make it appear that he was not aware of these things, and it was an ill-thought-out or ill-conceived plan that had been mongered by the army and had been screwed up by the army, which was quite far from the truth. And even if it had been the truth, nobody wants to be insulted or attacked by their own government. So that obviously does give reason to have distaste. But at the same time, capitulating to the United States or to the United Nations or to the rest of the world are facts of life in developing countries. And General Musharraf has been around long enough to know that there are a lot of positions, places where you make compromises, and you live to fight another day.
Now, what would we or the powers that be, the West and so on, what would they be demanding? How, or what would they be expecting? What should they expect and what should they demand with regard to the money that Pakistan is waiting for, about $3 billion, $280 million loan disbursement from the IMF alone? What should we ask of Pakistan and expect, and how soon, and how should it be tied to this money?
That's literally the $280 million question,
yeah.
George. And that is what I was talking about, that things may not have been thought through completely, because the Commonwealth ministers that were in Pakistan recently, they were not allowed to meet with or speak to Nawaz Sharif, who's still in custody and not seen since the day of the coup. Even though this is a bloodless coup, they would have expected to be able to make contact with him, but that was not allowed. So when clear signals are not sent, and if there is any kind of mystery, then there is also an element of mistrust or an element of let's wait and see. Now, if organizations like the IMF and everybody take a let's wait and see attitude, that does not bode well for Pakistan's economy. If that does not bode well for Pakistan's economy, that is going to make General Musharraf's job difficult, because no matter how celebratory the mood is in Pakistan right now, if he turns around and tells people, I have to raise the price of oil by 100%, electricity will be 3 times more expensive, and all these things will be done because we do not have money coming from abroad, that euphoria or whatever will go right back, because then people would rather be with a despotic elected cook than with somebody who came in and instead of solving the problems made them pay the price. So we would be back to square negative one in that case.
What kind of a, we're almost out of time, but I have to ask one final question. What kind of a time frame are you giving the general, and what are you expecting to see in that period?
I expect him to basically take the next few months putting together a kind of organization to look at these issues. I think he'll be buying time for the next 3 months at least, is how I see it happening. Now, this is the time when he should be reaching out to the United States, for example, and saying, we would like to bring democracy back, and you yourself are in agreement that Nawaz Sharif was not the right person for the government or for the people of Pakistan, and I am more than happy to step aside once the problems have been solved, so I need you to step in and help both economically, and you know that Kashmir is the root cause, so that is one of the things I would expect him to do. So he may have not been happy with Nawaz Sharif's capitulation, but he will be very willing to talk to the United States, and it is a great opportunity for the U.S. to play a positive role in solving the Kashmir problem, and hence solving the economic problems of more than 1 billion people.
How soon should he be willing to set up democratic elections?
I would not expect that to happen anytime before the middle of next year, if that soon.
And is that acceptable? Because some have said it should be done within 90 days, and others have said, given his problems, the magnitude of his problems, that in Pakistan, the fact is that it might take 2 or 3 years, and that would be ideal. In other words, it would be better for Pakistan if he was there and maintained a controlling hand for a number, 2 or 3 years as opposed to 90 days. What is your sense of that?
I agree with that practical logic, George, but the thing to keep in mind is that if 90 days is too soon by any count, so the problem is, and the 90 days word comes from the days of General Ziaul-Haq, who had falsely promised 90-day elections and never held them. What General Musharraf would be in a position to do in 6 months is to have the politicians, the crooked politicians, tied up in investigations, so technocrats and new people could come in and lead the country. That is one option, which would be a quick return to democracy, but might not necessarily solve the problems. And so the best thing to do would be to go for the 2 year and to solve the problems.
Imran, thank you very much, sir, and we will talk soon.
Thank you very much.
Imran Anwar, founder of ImranNet Services in New York, pioneer of Internet email in Pakistan, and, of course, a well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia.